It is 9:30 on Christmas Eve. As I sit down to write this, my young family are huddled around the fire in the drawing room, still telling ghost stories. It is a sport for them, a high-spirited and harmless game among young people. I can hear them now, vying with one another to tell the horridest, most spine-chilling tale. They speak of dripping stone walls in uninhabited castles, of secret dungeons and overgrown graveyards, howlings, shriekings, groanings and scuttlings, hooded monks and headless horsemen. This is sport indeed. An ancient tradition for the festive season. And to be sure, nothing of which I can possibly disapprove. The truth is quite other. And altogether more terrible.
Stepfather? Oh, here you are. We wondered where you were hiding.
I'm not hiding, Isabel. I'm just enjoying a little peace and quiet. Too much excitement for an old chap like me, I'm afraid.
I wonder you can bear to be alone after Edmund's story. It was the best yet, when those fingers started scratching at the window pane. I thought I should faint.
Yes, your brother certainly has a most vivid imagination.
What are you writing there?
Nothing. A letter. It's of no importance.
Good. Because it's your turn.
My turn for what?
To tell a story.
No, I don't think so.
Come on, stepfather, you must. Everyone else has. Even Mother managed one. Well, of sorts.
No, Isabel, I really would rather not.
Oh, don't be an old spoil sport. It is Christmas Eve.
No, I'm sorry. Nothing from me.
Isabel? We're all waiting. Come on.
It's stepfather. He's being a bit shy. He won't come.
Oh, I say, sir. Be a sport. We've got all the lights out, and the fire's died right down. Edmund's giving a corking performance of Hooting Owls and Howling Wind. Your audience awaits you.
Well, I fear they must wait on, Oliver. I'm quite comfortable in here, by myself.
Well, that's hardly the Christmas spirit, is it?
I'm sorry.
Isabel, go and fetch Mother. Tell her husband is being most uncooperative.
Isabel, wait.
Aha! I thought that would do the trick.
Both of you, please. Just leave me. Go back to the drawing room and amuse yourselves. I'm sure Edmund can come up with another tale in place of mine.
But that's not the point. It's a competition. We each tell one and then decide whose was the best. Oh, you must be able to think of one ghost story, surely.
Everybody knows at least one.
I'm...
Do your stuff, stepfather. Play the game.
Come on, please. You can't let us down.
Enough! I'm sorry to disappoint you all, but I have no story to tell.
Right. Fair enough. We'll,
Come on, it's getting late. I think perhaps it's time for bed.
Yes, right.
Good night, Father.
Good night, sir. Sorry to have interrupted you.
Oh, my dear Isabel, how right you are. I do have a story, a true story, a story of haunting and evil, fear and confusion, horror and tragedy. But it is not a story to be told around the fireside on Christmas Eve. I have always known, of course, in my heart, that the experience would never leave me, that it was now woven into my very fibres. And now tonight, it again fills my mind to the exclusion of all else. It seems the high spirits of my dear stepchildren have forced me to renew my acquaintance with that mortal dread and terror of spirit I had hoped forever dead. And I know I shall have no rest from it, shall lie awake in a chill of sweat until I've gone back to that other world and relived the horrors of that time, that place.
Arthur?
Oh, Esme, dearest.
Arthur! Arthur, what is it? What's wrong? Are you unwell? The children were quite upset. They said they'd never seen you so angry.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to... I'll apologise to them in the morning.
It's so unlike you, Arthur.
Yes, I know. I don't know what came over me. I simply felt a little unwell. Too much excitement, all that rich food, I suppose, and the heat. But it was unforgivable. I shall make amends tomorrow, I promise.
They love you, Arthur, like their own father. And I love you too. But we worry sometimes. You work too hard. You must try to rest. This is a holiday.
I know, I know, I know. And I shall, Esme, believe me.
Promise?
I promise.
Good. I'm going up now. Will you come?
Shortly. 5 more minutes, no more.
Good night, my darling. Now, don't be too long.
Good night, Esme. I recall that the way to banish an old ghost that continues its hauntings is to exorcise it. Well, then, mine shall be exorcised. I shall tell my tale, write my own ghost story. And then, perhaps, I shall at last be free to enjoy whatever life remains for me. Years have passed since then, some 30-odd. And yet, on this Christmas Eve, I can recall it all, every last terrible detail, as if it were yesterday.
The Woman in Black, from the novel by Susan Hill. Adapted for radio by John Strickland. Episode 1, A Journey and a Funeral.
Morning, Tones.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Kipp, sir. Shall I put your coat to dry, sir?
Yes, thank you, Tones. This fog, it's so damp. I'm quite soaked.
Yes, sir. Oh, it's a regular particular out there, sir.
Indeed it is, Tones. It's quite the dreariest month of the year, November. Lowering to the spirits. Mr. Bentley in yet?
Oh, yes, sir. Mr. Bentley has been at his desk an hour or more.
Well, yes. Well, it took rather longer than usual to get here this morning.
No, I'm sure it did, sir.
Still clinging onto that cold, Tones.
What cold's that, sir?
Right. Well, what have we first today, then?
Oh, more conveyancing, sir. Property leases.
Oh, dear. Dull work for a dull day, eh?
Mr. Bentley asks to see you first, sir.
Straight away?
As soon as you arrived, he said, sir.
Oh, right. Well, in we go, then.
Mr. Kipps is here, sir, finally.
Ah, good, Arthur. Come in, sit ye down, sit ye down. Thank you, Tomes.
I'm sorry I'm late, sir. I was just telling Tomes that...
I don't think I ever told you about the extraordinary Mrs. Drablow, Arthur.
No, sir.
Drablow, Mrs. Alice Drablow, Veal Marsh House. Dead, don't you know?
Ah, I'm sorry.
Yes, I inherited Mrs. Drablow from my father. Her family had had their business with this firm for... Oh, years.
Oh, yes.
She was a good age, 87.
And that's her will you have there, I take it, sir.
Mrs. Drablow was, as they say, a rum-un. Ever heard of the Nine Lives Causeway?
No, never.
Nor ever of Eel Marsh House?
No, sir.
Never visited the place at all?
No, I'm afraid not.
Oh, don't be afraid, Arthur. Living there, anyone might become rum.
Well, I've only a hazy idea of where it is.
And then, my boy, go home, pack your bags, and take the afternoon train from King's Cross, changing at Crewe, and again at Homerby. From Homerby, you take the branch line to the little market town of Criffin Gifford. And after that, it's a wait for the tide.
The tide, sir?
Well, you can only cross the causeway at low tide. That takes you onto Eel Marsh and the house.
Mrs. Drablow's.
When the tide comes in, you're cut off until it's low again. Remarkable place. Years since I was there, of course. My father took me. She didn't greatly care for visitors.
Was she a widow?
Since quite early in her marriage, yes.
Children?
Children? No. According to everything we've been told about Mrs. Drablow, no, there were no children.
Did she have a great deal of money or land?
Well, she owned a house, of course, and a few properties in Criffin Gifford, shops of tenants, that sort of thing. There is a poor sort of farm, half underwater. And there are the usual small trusts and investments.
Then it all sounds perfectly straightforward.
It does it not?
May I ask why I am to go there, sir?
Why? To represent this firm at the funeral of one of our oldest and most esteemed clients.
Oh, yes, of course.
I wondered whether to go up myself, naturally, but there is a chance Lord Boldrop will need to see me, so I really ought to be here, do you see?
Yes, of course, sir.
And then again, it is high time to put a little more onto your shoulders, Arthur. It's no more than you're capable of, isn't it?
I certainly hope not, sir. I'll be very glad to go up to Mrs. Drablow's funeral, naturally.
There is a bit more to it than that, Arthur.
The will?
Yes, that too. I'll let you have the details to read on your journey. But principally, you're to go through Mrs. Drablow's documents, her private papers, whatever they may be, wherever they may be, and bring them back to this office.
I see, sir.
Mrs. Drablow was somewhat disorganized, shall I say? It might take you a while.
A day or two?
Oh, at least a day or two, Arthur. Of course, things may have changed. I may be quite mistaken. Perhaps you'll clear it all up in an afternoon. As I say, it's many years since I was there.
And will there be anyone there to help me?
Oh, yes, I've made arrangements. There's a local man, Jerome, dealing with it all. He'll be in touch with you.
And presumably she had friends? Neighbours?
No. No. Eelmarsh House is far from any neighbours.
And being a rummun, she'd never made any friends, I suppose.
Well, come along, Arthur. Look on the bright side. Treat the whole thing as a jaunt. At least we'll take you out of this fog for a day or two. Now then, you'll reach Criffin Gifford by late this evening. There's a small hotel you can put up at for tonight, and the funeral is tomorrow morning at 11. Yes, Tomes?
Your 10 o'clock client, sir.
Good, good. Show him in, show him in. Right you are, Arthur. Any problems? I know I can trust you to uphold the firm's reputation.
Yes, sir. I hope you can, sir.
Well, don't dither in the doorway, man. There's work to do. Work to do and little time in which to do it.
Yes, sir. Well, Tomes?
We'll be needing your coat then, sir. Not had much of a chance to dry off yet, I'm afraid.
I must say, Tomes, for all it's a strange part of the world I'm going to, it's a relief to be leaving this appalling fog and unhealthy atmosphere.
Oh, you'll be needing these too, sir.
What? Oh, yes, the Drablow papers. Some light reading for the journey. Hey, Tomes.
I had to return to my rooms, pack a bag for a couple of nights, and scribble a note to my fiancée, Stella, whom I hoped to marry the following year. After that, I was to catch a train to a remote corner of England, of which until a few moments before I had barely heard. Nothing could have raised my spirits more than the sight of that great cavern of a railway station. I purchased newspapers at the bookstall and walked down the platform with a light step.
All aboard for crew! 12:43 for crew! All aboard now!
I found a corner seat in an empty compartment and settled down in great contentment. A couple of other passengers joined me, but after nodding briefly, were as intent on applying themselves to their papers as myself. Beyond the windows, it was quickly dark, and when the carriage blinds were down, all was as cosy and enclosed as some lamplit study, as we sped a good many uneventful miles towards the heart of England. At Crewe, I changed with ease and continued on my way. It was only when I came to change again onto the branch line at the small station of Homerby that I began to be less comfortable. The train in which I was to travel the last hour of my journey was ancient and comfortless, smelling of cold, stale smuts, the windows grimed, the floor unswept. Until the very last second, it seemed I was to be alone. But just at the blowing of the guard's whistle, another man climbed in, swinging the door shut as the train began to pull away.
It's a poor night out there.
Hmm?
It seems I've exchanged one kind of poor weather for another. I left London in the grip of an appalling fog, and up here it seems cold enough for snow.
It's not snow.
No?
The wind will blow itself out. Took the rain off with it by morning.
I'm very glad to hear it.
But if you think you've escaped the fog by coming up here, you're mistaken. We get bad frets in this part of the world.
Fret?
Ah, frets. Sea frets, sea mists.
Ah.
They roll up in a minute from the sea to land, across the marshes. It's the nature of the place. One minute it's as clear as a June day, the next, terrible.
Oh, I see.
Still, if you're staying at Crithen, you won't see the worst of it.
I stay there tonight, at the Gifford Arms Hotel, and tomorrow morning.
Aye.
I expect to go out and see something of the marshes later.
Is that right?
Yes. Well, I suppose I should use this time profitably. Would you excuse me?
Drablow.
I'm sorry?
On your envelope, dear. Mrs. Drablow. You don't tell me you're a relative.
Oh, no. No, I'm her solicitor, actually.
Ah, bound for funeral.
I am.
You'll be about the only one who is.
Oh? Oh, well, yes. Yes, I gather she had few friends, and no immediate family. Something of a recluse. I suppose that's sometimes the way with old ladies.
Aye, I suppose it is, Mr...
Oh, Kipps. Arthur Kipps. And you are?
Samuel Daly.
Ah. How do you do, Mr. Daly? Yes, they turn inwards, grow eccentric. I dare say it comes from living alone.
And when you live alone in such a place as that, it comes a good deal easier.
Oh, come now. You're not going to start telling me strange tales of lonely houses.
No, Mr. Kipps, that I am not.
How far have we to go?
12 mile. That was the last bit of high ground for a good while. You've come to the flatlands, Mr. Kipps. It's a far-flung part of the world. We don't get that many visitors. Where did you say you were stopping?
The Gifford Arms. Do you know it?
I'll drop you off there. It's on my way.
Well, it's very kind of you. Thank you.
And should you need anyone at any time, here's my card.
Well, thank you very much, but I think it's most unlikely. We have a local agent here. And anyway, I hope I shan't be here for more than a day or two.
Do you?
But, still, thanks very much. I'll keep it in my pocket anyway.
Now I can do another egg if you'd like, sir. It's no trouble.
No, this is...
Another pot of tea, then?
No, really, no, I've had quite sufficient. I'm still full from last night's supper.
Well, if you change your mind, just shout, sir. I'll only be in kitchen.
Thank you.
Good morning, sir. I'll just put a couple more knobs of coil on here. Did you sleep all right?
I think I can honestly say never better. I think the journey had tired me more than I thought.
Aye, it's a fair old jaunt from London, sir.
Seems a world away, if only for the weather. It's a beautiful morning out there by the look of it.
Aye, it's fresh. The sky's clear enough, but you'll be glad up fire when you get back. If you're planning to go out, that is, sir.
Oh, yes. I think I'll take a turn around the town. Explore a little.
Oh, it won't take you long, sir. It's a small enough place.
And none the worse for that, I'm sure.
Though, of course, today is busier than most, what with auction and market day falling together. That's what's brought you up here, is it, sir, the auction?
Auction?
Aye, public bar here at 11 o'clock. They're seeing off several farms from just south of here. I thought you'd come up for that.
No, I'm afraid at 11 o'clock this morning I have a rather more sombre engagement. I'm here to attend a funeral.
Oh, sorry to hear that, sir. A relative, is it?
No, it's a Mrs. Drablow of Eel Marsh House. Perhaps you knew of her.
Aye, I knew of her.
I'm her solicitor, or rather I represent her firm of solicitors. I never met her myself. I gather she kept rather out of the way for the most part.
Could hardly do otherwise living there.
Yes, I'm told.
I'll wish you good morning, sir, if you'll excuse me. I've work to do.
Yes, of course. How extraordinary. Yes?
Mr. Jerome's here to see you, sir.
Mr. Jerome?
Your agent, dear, sir. How do you do?
Oh, yes, of course. I'm sorry, Mr. Jerome. How do you do?
I trust you had a comfortable night, Mr. Kipps.
Yes, very, thank you.
I thought perhaps you might wish me to accompany you to the church, sir. I presume our little town is unfamiliar to you.
That's most thoughtful of you, Mr. Jerome. I've not had time to explore yet. The landlord was telling me today is market day, so the streets are somewhat busier than usual.
Indeed, sir. If I might suggest we leave now, we should be at the church just on 11.
Oh, good gracious, is that the time already? Right, yes, I'll just fetch my coat from upstairs. You'll wait for me here, Mr. Jerome.
Oh, yes, sir. I'll wait for you here, sir.
The landlord was right, Mr. Jerome. It's as busy as London and every bit as colourful.
Market day, sir. They come from all over.
This auction. Quite an important sale, I gather.
Large acreage, sir.
Half the land on the Omerby side of Cripping and for several miles east as well. 4 farms in all.
Here's good farming land around here is at a premium, I imagine. The area seems to be mostly marsh and salt flat. There'll be no shortage of bidders, I suppose.
Well, most will have more sense than to pit themselves against such as him.
And who on earth is such as him, Mr. Jerome?
Daly.
Daly? Samuel Daly?
You know him, Mr. Kipps.
No, I met him. Just briefly, on the train coming here. Is he a large landowner here, then?
He's buying up half the county.
And do I gather disliked because of it? Well, I may be doing business with him myself before the year is out. I suspect it's quite possible that Mrs. Drablow's estate will come up for sale in due course.
Oh, I doubt whether even Samuel Daly would go that far.
I don't think I fully understand you, Mr. Jerome. I know I haven't seen the full extent of Mrs. Drablow's land yet, but I gather there is a fair-sized farm a few miles out of town.
Hoggetts? 50 acres, Mr. Kipps. And half of it under flood for the best part of the year. Hoggetts is nothing.
Well, there's also Eel Marsh House and all the land surrounding it. Would not that be suitable for farming?
No, sir.
Well, might not Mr. Daly simply want to add a little more to his empire for the sake of being able to say that he had got it? You imply that he's that sort of man.
Aye. Maybe he is, sir. Maybe he is.
This is quite unsettling, Mr. Jerome. We seem to be the focus of considerable attention.
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, we're quite plainly being watched every step of the way. And yet each time I try to catch anybody's eye, they turn away. It's a most unpleasant sensation. I feel like some pariah.
Not to worry, Mr. Kipps. This is the church here.
Oh, thank heavens for that. I know I'm a stranger here, but really, I was beginning to feel as if I had 2 heads.
After you, sir.
Thank you.
We seem to be the only people here, Mr. Jerome. She must have been lonelier than I thought. Very sad. I take it she's to be buried in the churchyard here?
That is so.
Is there a family grave?
No. At least not here, not in this churchyard.
Somewhere else?
It's no longer in use. The area's unsuitable.
I'm sorry?
I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another. Behold, I show you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump. For the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed.
Corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality. Then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?
I see the old lady did have one friend after all.
Therefore, my beloved, the woman stood several rows behind us, and quite alone. She must have slipped into the church after we'd taken our places. She was dressed in deepest black, in a style that was somewhat out of fashion. A bonnet covered her head and shaded her face. But I could still see enough to recognize that she was suffering from some terrible wasting disease. She was extremely pale, and her skin was tautly stretched across her bones, so that it gleamed with a curious blue-white sheen. Her eyes seemed sunken back into her head, as though she had been a victim of starvation. She was quite possibly no more than 30, and it seemed to me unspeakably poignant that a woman, perhaps only a short time away from her own death, should drag herself to the funeral of another.
He cometh up and is cast down like a flower. He fleeth, as it were, a shadow, and never continueth in one stay.
We should follow the coffin, Mr. Gibbs. Miss Gibbs?
What? Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course.
Who for our sins art justly displeased? Forasmuch as it hath pleased Almighty God of his great mercy to take unto himself the soul of our dear sister here departed, we therefore commit her body to the ground, earth to earth, ashes to ashes,
dust to dust. Amen.
Amen. Amen.
My deepest condolences, Mr. Jerome, young man.
Thank you. A simple service, but no less moving.
Are you perhaps a relative of the deceased?
Mr. Kipps represents Mrs. Drabble's legal advisers, nothing more.
Ah, I see. Well, a duty done, Mr. Jerome. A duty done.
Indeed. Good day to you, sir.
Yes, good day. Well, a melancholy little service, Mr. Jerome.
Indeed, sir. You'll be returning to your hotel, no doubt, sir.
Yes, although I would like a word with a young woman first. Perhaps I can be of some assistance to her.
I beg pardon, sir.
Well, I hope she can find her own way home. She looks so dreadfully unwell. Who is she? The young woman with the wasted face, at the back of the church and then in the graveyard.
A young woman?
Yes, dressed in black. Well, look, there she is now, over by that tree. Is there anything the matter, Mr. Jerome? You look unwell.
Oh,
Mr. Jerome, are you all right? Look, if you can just walk a few steps back to the porch, you can rest and recover while I go for help. A car.
No!
But my dear fellow...
No! I do apologize. I'm so sorry. It's nothing, a passing faintness. I think it would be best if you would just walk back with me towards my offices in Penn Street. Just off the square.
Well, if you're sure...
Quite sure.
But, Mr. Jerome, please wait, are you sure?
But Mr. Jerome was hurrying away, almost running in his eagerness to get out of the churchyard. It was an extraordinary scene. Only seconds earlier, he had been on the verge of a complete collapse, triggered apparently by my reference to the young Lady Moona, and yet now he moved like a man possessed, out of the churchyard, past a row of small children, lined up against the iron railings, staring in at the mournful proceedings. Their pale, solemn faces with great, round eyes, their little hands gripping the railings tightly, each one of them silent and quite motionless. It was a strangely grave and touching sight. As I followed Mr. Jerome, I caught the eye of one and smiled at him gently. But he looked at me blankly, his expression almost disturbingly unchildlike. Had I been less concerned with catching up with Mr. Jerome and making sure he was all right, then I might have felt rather more clearly the distinct chill that was settling over the graveyard, despite the bright autumn sunshine that made the distant marshes shimmer and gleam on the far horizon.
In the first episode of The Woman in Black by Susan Hill, dramatized for radio by John Strickland, Old Kipps was played by John Woodvine, Young Kipps by Robert Glenister, Esme by Paula Tilbrook, Tomes by Christopher Kent, Mr. Bentley by Stuart Richman, Samuel Daly by Rod Arthur, Isabel by Jane Marlowe, and Oliver by Jason Doan. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Peter Bellum, Steve Brook, and Maggie Richmond. The music was specially composed by Derek Pierce. The Woman in Black was directed in Manchester by Chris Wallace.
This is BBC Radio 4 Extra.
So next this hour, it's time to discover some books worth reading in this week's archive edition of A Good Read.
Hello, welcome to A Good Read, where my guests today are a lord and a best-selling novelist. The novelist first is Mavis Cheek, who began her literary career as a journalist and travel writer, but hit her stride with what you might call social satire or romantic fiction, though she treasures a critic's description.
Woman in Black, from the novel by Susan Hill. Adapted for radio by John Strickland. Episode 2, A Causeway and a Pony Trap.
You may leave me here, Mr. Kipps. My office is just above the shop, thank you.
You are most welcome, Mr. Jerome. Although, are you quite sure you're recovered?
You didn't seem at all well back there at the churchyard.
I've already apologised, Mr. Kipps. I assure you it was nothing.
Well, I think the walk back must have done you good. You've a good deal more colour now than you had a few moments ago.
As I said, sir, a passing faintness, nothing more.
Yes, quite. Now then, what time shall I return?
Return, Mr. Kipps?
Yes. Are you not to take me over to Ilmarsh House later?
I think there must be some mistake, sir. I shall not go across there. You can cross any time after 1 o'clock. Kepwick will come for you. He's always been the go-between to that place. I take it you have a key.
Yes. Brought one up from London with me.
Good. He'll call for you at the Gifford Arms, sir, within the hour.
All right. I do want to get there today, if I can. It'll enable me to make a start, at least, though I shall probably have to go across again tomorrow. I really have no idea what I'll find until I get there. It would no doubt make much more sense to sleep there overnight.
Oh, I think you'd find it much more comfortable to continue staying where you are, sir.
Well, the food is certainly first rate. Yes, you may be right.
I'm sure I am, sir.
So long as it causes no one any inconvenience.
You'll find Kepwick perfectly obliging, sir.
I'm sure I will.
Though not very communicative. Now, if you will forgive me...
Mr. Jerome scuttled away again like a rabbit to its hole. I half moved to call him back, for I was becoming curiously irritated by his evasiveness, and thought of trying to get out of him exactly what was meant by it. It all seemed to hint of silly local tales which had grown out of all proportion. Doubtless, in such a place as this, with its eerie marshes, sudden fogs, moaning winds, and lonely houses, any poor old woman like Mrs. Drablow might be looked at askance. Once upon a time, after all, she would have been branded as a witch. For my own part, as I crossed the square back to the hotel to wait for Mr. Kepwick, I resolved to enjoy the whole business, to relish my new-found responsibility. I would endeavour to be amused by it all, as adding no more than a touch of spice and local colour to my expedition.
Come on, come on. What's keeping you, man? Yeah, come in.
Oh, it's only me, Mr. Kipps. I'm sorry to interrupt, but will you be here for your lunch? Only we it being market day, it'd help if I had some idea at numbers.
Well, it's beginning to look as if I shall be stuck here all day. I was expecting a Mr. Kepwick to take me across to Ilmarsh House, but I dare say Mr. Jerome forgot to tell him.
Kepwick? Why, he's outside, sir. I wondered who he were waiting on.
He's outside?
Aye, oh, he's been there 10 minutes or more.
Well, why didn't he come in and announce himself? I've been sitting here for the last half an hour.
Am I to tell him you're on your way, sir?
No, no, it's all right. I'm quite ready. I'll find him myself.
As you like, sir. Oh, does that mean you'll be back for your supper, then?
Yes, though I'm not sure what time. That rather depends on what I find out there.
At Ilmarsh, sir?
Well, yes, that's where I'm headed.
Aye. Well, no doubt you'll be back before dark, Mr. Kipps. Kepwick will see to that, I'm sure.
Will he? Good. Now, look, I really must go before our Mr. Kepwick takes it into his head to leave us as anonymously as he arrived.
Now, you take care out there, Mr. Kipps.
Mr. Kepwick?
Mr. Kipps?
Oh, you're Mr. Kepwick. I'm sorry, I was expecting a car for some reason. But this is delightful. Do I climb up?
Without, you want to walk behind?
I beg your pardon? Oh, right, yes. If I can just use this to pull myself. There.
Get over there!
Oh! Well, I say, this is quite a novel experience for me, Mr. Kepwick. It's a while since I've ridden in a pony and trap. I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, Mr. Kepwick, back at the hotel. I didn't realise you'd arrived until Mrs. The landlord's wife told me. You see, I'm afraid you were sitting outside and I was sitting inside, both of us twiddling our thumbs for a good 10 minutes. Still, no matter. It's a beautiful morning at the time of year. Should be good for business today. Ah, it's the church again. This is the second time I've seen it today. I was at the funeral this morning. Mrs. Drablow's. It all seemed to pass off fairly smoothly. Solemnly. Not that there was actually a very large turnout. Just one mourner. Apart from Mr. Jerome and myself, of course. In fact, you might be able to help me, Mr. Kepwick. You see, I wasn't able to speak to the young lady at the time, or indeed even to find out her name. But perhaps you might know her.
She was fairly tall, slim, dressed entirely in black and of the most gaunt appearance. In fact, I would have to say that she looked quite desperately unwell. I can't imagine there is another in the town who looks like her. Would you have any idea who she might be?
Go on, get out of there!
Keckwick was marginally more taciturn than Mr. Jerome, if that were possible. He was certainly not to be drawn on the identity of the mysterious woman in black, and I very quickly abandoned all attempts to engage him in conversation. Instead, I concentrated on my immediate surroundings as we drove on out into open country, leaving Criffin Gifford and all its market day bustle far behind. And what country it was! All around and above and way beyond, there seemed to be sky. Sky, and only a thin strip of land. As we drove briskly across the absolutely flat land, we passed no farm or cottage, scarcely even a tree. All was emptiness. The hedgerows petered out. The ploughed soil gave way to rough grass, dikes, and ditches filled with water. And then we were approaching the marshes themselves. We seemed to be journeying towards the very edge of the world.
And this must be the Nine Lives Causeway we're on now, Mr. Keckwick, eh? Presumably, when the tide comes in, it's quite submerged.
Easy, girl. Easy.
Not a place to come without a good knowledge of the local tides, eh? But quite astoundingly beautiful nonetheless. I never imagined such a place as... Good gracious! That, I take it, is Ealhmarsh House. Up ahead.
Aye, that's her.
It stood like some lighthouse or beacon, rising as if out of the water itself. A tall, gaunt house of grey stone, with a slate roof that gleamed like steel in the pale light. It was quite simply the most astonishingly situated house I had ever seen, or could ever conceivably have imagined. Isolated, uncompromising.
Handsome, Mr. Keckwick. That's a quite astonishingly handsome house. I've never seen the like.
Oh, there. Oh!
Thank you, Mr. Keckwick. Well, I simply don't know what to say. I am truly speechless. I've certainly never been anywhere quite like this. It's a rather strange sensation. Lonely as could be, but also exciting. Disturbing, I was going to say. Although, to be sure, there's nothing here to frighten.
There's not much here at all, Mr. Kipps.
Indeed. Wind, marsh birds, reeds and still water. It's a rare and beautiful spot. I can hardly wait to explore the place. Sorry. Sorry. I was quite transported for a moment. How long will that causeway remain passable?
Till about five.
Oh, is that all? Well, listen, it'll be quite ridiculous for you to be driving to and fro twice a day like this. I think the best thing will be for me to bring my bags and some food and drink, of course, and stay over a couple of nights.
Stop here?
Oh, yes. It seems the most sensible course of action. So for now, I'd simply like you to collect me before the tide comes in this afternoon, and then tomorrow morning bring me back out here as early as possible. If you are agreeable, that is.
It's not for me to be agreeable.
Or you perhaps prefer to wait here for me now, though I shall be a couple of hours. You know what suits you best.
Getcha! Where are they?
And a very good day to you too, Mr. Keckwick. Extraordinary people. I think you may have had the right idea, Mrs. Drablow. Staying out here as far away from them all as possible. Now then, let's have a look at exactly what Ealhmarsh comprises.
I walked away from the house, across an area of scrub and field, towards the ruins of some old church or chapel, which I'd noticed earlier as we approached the island. To the west, the sun was already beginning to shoot arrows of fire and blood-red streaks across the water. To the east, sea and sky had darkened slightly to a uniform leaden grey. Behind the crumbling arches of the derelict chapel was a small burial ground, enclosed by the remains of a wall. There were perhaps 50 gravestones, most of them leaning over or completely fallen, covered in patches of greenish-yellow lichen and moss, scoured pale by the salt wind and stained by years of driven rain. No names or dates were now decipherable, and the whole place had an air of decay and abandon.
Well, perhaps on a warm summer evening it's altogether different. But for now, Mrs. Drablow, it's about as bleak and eerie a place as I can think of. It's time to go inside, I think. Oh! I'm sorry. I didn't mean to disturb your nest, whatever you are. Is there such a bird as a sea vulture? Yes, you really are enormous and very ugly. I don't... You. How on earth did you...
It was the young woman again. The young woman from the funeral. She was standing at the far end of the graveyard, wearing the same black dress and bonnet. She was standing quite motionless, staring directly at me.
Good afternoon. I do apologize for surprising you like this. My name is Arthur Kipps. I'm from Bentley Hague, Sweetman and Bentley. Mrs. Drablow's solicitors in London. Obviously, no one informed you that I would be coming.
And still she stared at me, with that expression of... I can only describe it as an expression of desperate, yearning malevolence. It was as if she was searching for something, something which had been taken from her, and towards whoever had taken it, she now directed the purest loathing, hatred, the purest evil. Towards me. And yet, I had taken nothing from her. I didn't even know who she was. I had never in my life been so suddenly possessed by fear. As my eyes were held by hers, my knees began to tremble. I could feel my body turning as cold as stone. My heart gave a great lurch, began pounding on my chest like a hammer on an anvil. It was as though I had become paralyzed. Even now, all these years later, I can still feel my flesh begin to creep. I could not bear to stay there, but I had no strength left in my body to turn and run. I was as certain as I had ever been of anything that at any second I would simply fall dead on the ground. And then, quite suddenly, she was gone, slipping silently behind one of the gravestones and away through a gap in the wall.
Wait! Come back, please! I just want to know who you are. Perhaps I can help you. What? That's not possible. Where's she gone? There is nowhere to hide out here. I can see for miles. No! Who is she? Who is she?
Oh, I did not believe in ghosts. Not then. And yet, in the desolation of that burial ground, in that peculiar fading light, I had just seen a woman whose form was in some essential respect ghostly. She had appeared and then vanished in a way that no real living human being could possibly manage to do.
But I could have touched her. I saw her quite clearly. She was there. She was real. No. No, I do not believe in ghosts. There's an explanation for this. Somewhere in this old house there is an explanation. Hello? Hello, it's Arthur Kipps again. I didn't mean to startle you just now. All right, Kipps. Compose yourself. Now, first know your territory. Right. Hallway. Oak staircase leading off. Passage to kitchen and scullery, I presume. Drawing room. Leading through to...
Sitting room. Dining room. All with a rather musty, sweet-sour smell. Though I suppose that's hardly surprising. It must have been shut up for some time now.
There was nothing dramatic or unpleasant. The furniture in each room was old-fashioned, but good. Solid, dark. Many of the rooms had clearly not been used for years. The whole place was curiously impersonal. The furnishings, the ornaments, the decoration, all dull, gloomy, and rather unwelcoming. Here was nothing elegant, nothing that spoke of individuality or taste, nothing to give me the slightest clue as to the identity of the young woman in black I had now seen in two separate graveyards.
Small parlour and study. None of it quite to your taste, I'm afraid, Stella. Perhaps we won't move here after all. Now then, what precisely is inside all these cupboards and drawers?
Oh! My goodness!
It was a cascade of old papers. As I worked my way around the various desks, bureaus and writing tables, I gradually revealed a mountain of correspondence, receipts, legal documents, notebooks, tied up in bundles, yellow with age. Most of it probably worthless, but all of it requiring close examination before I could decide which of it needed to be carried back to London for Mr. Bentley's attention.
This is a huge task. Did you ever throw away a single piece of paper in your life, Mrs. Drablow? Oh, there's no point in starting this now. It's far too late.
In truth, I was simply too unnerved to consider starting then. The business with the woman in the graveyard had succeeded in unsettling my London composure more than I cared to admit. How Mrs. Drablow had endured day after day, night after night of isolation in that house, and for so many years, I could not conceive. I had been there one afternoon, and already I had had enough of the monotonous greyness, the gloomy melancholy that seemed to be all around, inside and out. I decided a good brisk walk, though not anywhere near the old burial ground again, would put me in better heart. It would be another hour before Keckwick returned for me, and if I stepped out well, I knew I would either reach Criffin Gifford in time to save him turning out at all, or, at the very least, meet him on the way.
Well, at least there's a good supper waiting for me at the Gifford Arms.
On the causeway path, it was still quite dry underfoot, although to my left, I saw that the water had begun to seep nearer, quite silent, quite slow. I wondered how deeply the path went under water when the tide was right in. Although on a still night such as this, I knew there was plenty of time to cross in safety, even though the distance was greater on foot than it had seemed when we trotted over in Keckwick's pony cart.
Come on, Kipps. Step out. Step out.
Once or twice, I glanced back over my shoulder, half expecting to catch sight of the young woman following me. Perhaps she would catch up with me, explain that the shock of seeing me so unexpectedly in the burial ground had made her shy, but that now she had fully recovered, and please, would I not return with her and join her for a cup of tea whilst we waited for Mr. Keckwick in the warmth? By now, I'd almost persuaded myself there must have been some slope or dip in the ground into which she had concealed herself earlier, before returning to some lonely dwelling tucked down out of sight. After all, I'd not actually searched for her hiding place, but merely glanced around and seen nothing. And the changes of light in such a place can play all manner of tricks. As indeed was being proved to me at that very moment. For peering into the greyness ahead, it seemed to me that the end of the causeway was receding from me the further I walked towards it. Very soon, I could not actually see my goal at all.
It's a sea fret. The sea fret Mr. Daly told me about.
Almost without me realizing, A thick, damp sea mist had rolled over the marshes as I walked, and enveloped everything. Myself, the house behind me, the causeway ahead.
This is quite absurd. I can't see anything.
It was choking, thick and salty, moving in front of my eyes. I felt confused, teased by it, as if it were made up of millions of live fingers that crept over me, hung on me, and then shifted away again.
I'd better go back. I'll wait for this to clear. I'm sure Mr. Daly said they lift as quickly as they fall. Oh, God, where's the path? I should have brought a torch. Help! Can anyone hear me? Oh, please, are you there? Young lady! This is ridiculous. Please, let me reach the house. Can anyone hear me? I need help! Help! Kepwick! Oh, thank God. Kepwick! Mr. Kepwick! Over here! I'm here! Kepwick! Over here! I can't see! No! No! Kepwick! Kepwick! Oh, dear God. Kepwick! No! No! No!
To this day, I couldn't tell you how I reached the house, or how long I lay there in the hallway, weeping in an agony of fear and frustration. I had heard, beyond any doubt, the terrible last sounds of a pony and trap. A pony and trap carrying a child, as well as Kepwick, struggling desperately as it was sucked under by the quicksand. And I'd been able to do nothing, nothing, but stand and listen as those poor creatures slowly choked and drowned in the mud and water. I do know that eventually I was able to pull myself together sufficiently to go about the house, switching on every light I could make work, hoping, against all reason, that it would be seen like a lightship by someone, somewhere across that dark, misty wasteland. Every room I went to was orderly, dusty, bitterly cold and damp, yet also somehow stifling. As I moved around the house, I grew more rather than less agitated. I began to be angry at Mr. Bentley for sending me here, at my own foolishness in ignoring all the hints and veiled warnings I'd received about the place. And when I came to one door, the only door that was locked, with no keyhole, no bolt on the outside, I'm afraid my anger exploded.
What is it? Oh, yes, wait, yeah, I'm coming. Who is it? Who's out there?
Mr. Kipps?
Kepwick? No.
You have to wait for a fret like that to clear itself. Don't cross it over while the fret's up. Unlucky for you, that were.
Kepwick? How did you...
After that, there's the wait for the tide. Awkward place. You'll be finding that out fast enough.
What time is it?
2.
In the morning? It can't be. I haven't slept that... I was trying to attract attention. With the light.
Wouldn't have left you over the night. Wouldn't do that to you.
No, thank you. I'm most grateful to you.
Aye.
But what happened to you? How do you manage to be here? How did you get out?
Best climb up, Mr. Kipps.
It wasn't you, was it? Out there on the marsh. It was someone else. Who, Mr. Kirkwick? Who in their right mind would have been driving out there on a night like this and with a young child? Who was it?
Just wanting to get home, Mr. Kipps.
Yes. Yes, I must lock up the house before. Thank you.
Come on, girl. Get up.
I fell into a sort of trance, half sleeping, half waking, rocked by the motion of the cart. I knew that I had entered some hitherto unimagined realm of consciousness, that coming to this place had already changed me, and that there was no going back. I had seen things I'd never dreamed of seeing, and heard things too. I knew then that the woman by the graves had been ghostly, and I began to suspect, as we crossed the now quite clear causeway beneath the riding moon, that the pony and trap I had heard out on the marsh, the pony and trap with the child who had cried out so terribly and which had been sucked into the quicksands, they too had not been real, not there, present, substantial, but ghostly also. Oh, what I had heard, I had heard. What I had seen, the woman with the pale, wasted face by the grave of Mrs. Drablow and again in the old burial ground, I had seen. I would have sworn an oath to it. And yet, they had been, in some sense I did not then understand, unreal, ghostly, things that were dead.
Come on now, get up!
In episode 2 of The Woman in Black by Susan Hill, dramatized for radio by John Strickland, Old Kipps was played by John Woodvine, Young Kipps by Robert Glenister, The Landlady by Paula Tilbrook, Mr. Jerome by Stuart Richman, and Kekwick by James Quinn. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Peter Bellum, Maggie Richmond, and Steve Brook. The music was specially composed by Derek Pierce. The Woman in Black was directed in Manchester by Chris Wallace.
This is BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now it's time to explore another piece of music with a powerful emotional impact. It's soul music.
Christmas future is far away, Christmas past is past, Christmas present is...
Woman in Black, from the novel by Susan Hill. Adapted for radio by John Strickland. Episode 3, A Nursery and a Child.
Mr. Kipps, are you late?
Yes, come in.
Oh, morning, Mr. Kipps. Oh, and a grand morning it is too. I've brought you a break. First.
Oh, thank you. That's most kind.
What time is it?
Oh, it's about 11, sir. I didn't wake you. Are you feeling better this morning? You were in quite a state last night.
Well, I can't say I slept all that well, I'm afraid. I seem to have an overdose of bad dreams.
Ah, well, did hear you calling out once or twice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, not to be sorry for, sir. It's that place.
Eelmarsh House?
Aye.
What about it?
Well, it plays some nasty tricks.
Tricks?
On the mind, sir.
Yes. Yes, I realise that now.
Aye. Still, you're here. No harm done. No need to go back, I'm sure.
No. No, I shall not be going back to Eelmarsh.
Good. Now, I'll leave you to have your breakfast now, sir. There's no worry. You get up when you like. I should try and sleep some more, sir. Help me, I'll not be so restless now.
Thank you. But I think what I really need this morning is some exercise and the fresh air. Perhaps I'll walk into the countryside a mile or so.
Well, you'll find it nice and easy walking. Or else we can lend you a good stout bicycle.
A bicycle? Yeah. Ah, now that's a much more appealing idea. Stella, my fiancée, and I are both keen cyclists.
Well, you'll find my husband's round back in the yard there. Oh, you just help yourself, sir, if the fancy takes you.
Thank you, I will.
Oh, you're welcome, sir. It's good to have you back, safe and sound. Now, I'll leave you to finish in peace. And if there's aught else you want, just call out.
I had a better appetite than I had expected. As I ate, I put to myself various alternatives. The previous night, and even that morning when I spoke to the landlord's wife, I had been adamant in my own mind. I was having nothing more to do with Eelmarsh and the Drablow business. I would telegraph Mr. Bentley, leave matters in the hands of Mr. Jerome, and take the first available train back to London. In short, run away. I had been as badly frightened as a man could be. And yet, already, looking out at the sharp blue sky, a good breakfast inside me, my mind was no longer quite so made up. I knew that an hour's brisk cycling would do much to refresh and restore me. But I also knew, only too well, that in order to extricate myself from the whole affair, I would have to invent some excuse for Mr. Bentley. For the truth, for someone sitting in a warm office in London, would be an open invitation to ridicule and disbelief, and the probable end of my career. Despite everything that had happened to me, despite what I'd said to the landlady, I knew deep down in my heart that, in fact, I would return to Eelmarsh House. But first, I had to pay someone a visit.
Horatio Jerome, land and estate agent. Good.
Oh, it's you.
Indeed it is, Mr. Jerome. Good morning to you.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Kipps.
May I come in?
Well, I've not much time.
Oh, this shouldn't take long, Mr. Jerome. One or two questions, no more, I promise.
Very well. I'll do my best, though I'll tell you now, I know very little.
Well, I'll come straight to the point. You see, I had no idea, I don't know whether you had, of the volume of papers belonging to Mrs. Drabler. Tons of the stuff. Most of it, I've no doubt, so much waste, but it will have to be gone through, item by item, nevertheless.
Indeed.
Well, it seems to me that unless I am to take up residence in Criffin Gifford for the foreseeable future... Yes, quite. I shall have to have some help.
Oh, no. I'm afraid I can't offer you help, Mr. Gibbs.
Well, I wasn't thinking you would do anything personally. But perhaps you have a young assistant.
No, there's no one. I'm quite on my own here. I can't give you any help at all.
Well, help me find someone, then. Surely the town will yield me a young man with a modicum of intelligence, keen to earn a few pounds.
I'm sorry, this is a small place. Young people leave. There are no openings, you see.
But I am offering an opening, Mr. Jerome, albeit temporary.
You'll find no one suitable.
Mr. Jerome, what you mean is not that there is no one suitable. If a thorough search were to be made, I am quite certain we should find at least one or two suitable candidates for the job.
You
are backing away from speaking the truth of the matter, Mr. Jerome, which is that I should not find a soul willing to spend any time out at Eelmarsh House for fear of the stories about the place proving true, for fear of encountering what I have already encountered.
Kekwick came back for you.
Yes. I was more grateful than I can say.
There's nothing Kekwick doesn't know about Eelmarsh House.
Do I take it he fetched and carried for Mrs. Drabbler?
Oh, she saw no one else. Not another living...
Not another living soul.
There are stories, tales, is all that nonsense.
I can believe that.
You can discount most of it.
But not all?
You saw that woman in the churchyard.
And I saw her again. She was in the old burial ground on the island. What are those ruins?
There was a monastery once, long before the house was built. It was abandoned, left to decay, centuries ago.
And the burial ground?
There was some later use, a few graves.
The Drabblers.
Mr. Gibbs, I'm sorry, but...
Mr. Jerome, I'm afraid I am not going to be put out by a ghost. Or indeed several ghosts. My time out there so far has not been altogether pleasant, I confess, and I should be glad to find a companion with whom to share the work. And it is work that has to be done. And anyway, I doubt if the woman in black can have any animosity toward me personally. Who was she? Is she? I hardly know how to refer to her.
You must excuse me, Mr. Kipps. I have a good deal of my own work to do.
Yes, of course. I simply wanted to tell you that I am quite determined to face it out, Mr. Jerome. Such things one must face.
Oh, so I said, Mr. Kipps. So I said, once.
Oh, for heaven's sake, man, don't worry about it. I doubt very much if I shall set eyes on the woman again, and if I do, I am more than capable of looking after myself.
Mr. Jerome's apparent fear served only to strengthen my own resolve. I questioned him no further, deciding that if I were to get to the truth of the business, I should have to rely on the evidence of my own senses and nothing more. In the light of Mr. Jerome's extreme reaction, I felt this was perhaps the best option anyway.
There's a man with a spring in his step. Mr. Kipps, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, Mr. Daly from the train. Good morning.
I thought it were you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
That's good.
Yes, I've just been to see Mr. Jerome.
Jerome? And how is the business?
Mrs. Drablow's estate. Oh, I shall soon have all that in order. Though I confess there is rather more to do than I thought.
Been out to the house?
Certainly, I was out there yesterday.
Ah.
Yes, to tell you the truth, I rather enjoyed it. Quite a challenge.
Was it now?
Yes, it was. You seem doubtful, Mr. Daly.
Mr. Kipps, you are whistling in the dark.
I'm sorry?
Come for some dinner tonight. 7 o'clock.
Well, that's kind of you. Thank you. Yes, I will.
Your landlord will tell you the way.
Thank you. I'll see you at 7, then.
It's too big for us, really. Just the two of us now.
We rattle round like peas on a drum.
No.
It's an impressive place, Mrs. Daly. Oh. You must be very proud.
Money, Mr. Kipps. That's what it's about. I'm not ashamed to say I've made a few pounds in my life. And this place is just to let everyone know. Something for them to grind their teeth over of an evening.
Well, do they resent your success, then?
I've no idea, Mr. Kipps. Though I wouldn't be surprised.
Oh, Samuel.
What?
Whatever will Mr. Kipps think of us?
He can think what he likes. I'm speaking now but the truth. Now then, how about a port? We'll go through to the study.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Daly, for a delicious dinner and truly delightful company.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Mr. Kipps. Perhaps next time we might look forward to meeting your fiancé.
Next time? I don't suppose he'll be up here again before he has to.
Samuel!
Come on, Arthur, before I say something else wrong. Right, set yourself down.
Thank you. Your very good health.
You're a fool if you go on with it, you know.
I beg your pardon? Oh, you're referring to my business at Eel Marsh.
Listen, I'm not going to fill you up with a lot of old wives' tales. You'd find those out fast enough if you ask about the place. Maybe you already have.
No, only hints. And Mr. Jerome turning a little pale.
But you went out there.
Yes, I went there. And I had an experience I shouldn't care to go through again. Though I confess I can't explain it.
Have a try.
It seems to me, Mr. Daly, that I have seen whatever ghost it is that haunts Eel Marsh in that burial ground. A woman in black with a wasted face. Because I have no doubt at all that the young woman I saw was what people call a ghost. Well, she did me no harm. She neither spoke nor came near me. I did not like her look. And I liked the power that seemed to emanate from her towards me even less.
but I have convinced myself that it is a power that cannot do more than make me feel afraid. If I go there and see her again, I am prepared.
That's good, Arthur. That's very good. And what about the pony and trap? And the child?
Mr. Daly, if you think I should give up the job I've been sent here to do and turn tail and run, then
I shouldn't go there.
I'm afraid I'm going.
You shouldn't go there alone.
I can find no one to go with me.
No, I don't suppose you can.
Good God, man, Mrs. Drablow lived alone there for, what was it, 60-odd years? She must have come to terms with all the ghosts about the place.
Aye, maybe that's just what she did do.
Look, I think I'd better get back to the hotel. I had a late night last night.
Fair enough.
Thank you for your hospitality, and please thank Mrs. Daly once more.
You want a lift back?
No, thank you. I'd prefer to walk. Get some fresh air.
As you like. You sit on it, then?
Yes, yes, I am.
Then take a dog.
Actually, I haven't got a dog with me.
I have. Come on! In here! Take her. Bring her back when you're done.
Well, will she come with me?
She'll do what I tell her.
What's her name?
Spider.
Spider. All right, I'll be glad of her company, I confess. Thank you. Come on, then. Spider. Here. Come, girl.
Go on, girl. Stay with him.
His master's voice.
Coffee, sugar, and a couple of loaves, some butter, ham, fruit, tomatoes, and a tin of biscuits. Oh, and I've put you in a slice of my apple tart, too.
Well, there's sufficient here to last me a week. I hope to be there no more than a couple of nights at the most.
Well, better too much than too little, Mr. Kipps, though. I don't know why you have to stop over there at all. I'm sure Keckwick wouldn't mind coming out to fetch you back.
No, it makes much more sense. The whole business will be finished much more quickly. All right, Spider-Rock, we're going in a minute. There's a good girl.
Well, me husband's dug out a torch in some Wellingtons. I don't know that they'll fit your mind.
Oh, I'm sure they'll do in an emergency. Thank you.
Now, come on, I'll give you a hand with this hamper.
Good. Come on, Spider. I think we're finally on our way.
Now, you take care, Mr. Kipps. Don't be too proud.
Come on, Spider. Keep up. Nearly there.
The sun was high, the water glittering. Everywhere was light, space and brightness. The very air seemed somehow purified and more exhilarating. Once I'd arrived at Eel Marsh House, I spent half an hour establishing myself, building a fire in the drawing room, setting linen and blankets to air, letting up blinds and opening windows. And then, seated at a large desk, a pot of tea at my right hand, Spider at my feet, I commenced work. It was pretty tedious going, but I persevered patiently enough, untying and cursorily examining bundle after bundle of worthless old papers, ancient household accounts, banker statements and doctor's prescriptions, letters, Christmas cards.
There's even shopping lists here, Spider. This is all just so much waste paper apart from the letters. Oh, I suppose I must read them properly later on. Oh, how about a walk, eh? I don't have some fresh air, I'm going to fall asleep. Come on. Go on, then. Go on. What do you want, eh? You want me to throw you a stick? All right, then. Okay. Go on, then. Fetch. That's it. Good girl. Come on. This way. Let's take a look at the burial ground. See if we can find my young friend.
In loving memory, something Jen, something Humphrey, 1860 something, Andover something something, I.E. Drablow. This was the stone she was standing next to, Spider. Where is she today, eh? I wonder.
Come on, it's too cold out here. I'll race you back. Go on, Spider. Go on, grab it.
Statement of account.
Spider. I really don't think I can do much more of this tonight. You're not keeping much of an eye on the fire, are you? It'll be out in a minute. You wait here while I fetch some wood. Now, where's that torch? Ah, here it is. All right, I'm here, you silly animal. Frightened on your own, were you? There. That'll soon burn up again, eh, Spider? You like your fire, don't you? Where did it go? What's wrong? Did you think I was going to leave you just now, eh? Come on, it's all right. I was only... That's inside, Spider. There's somebody in the house. No, it's all right, dear. It's all right. Come on. Let's go and find out what it is, eh? Come on. You come with me. That's it. It's up here, Spider. Come on. Come on. This way. Stay with me now. This is the door I couldn't open before. It's locked, and yet there's no keyhole. Whoever it is, whatever it is on the other side of that door, Spider. Nothing here. No one. Who are you?
When I awoke the next morning, for somehow I had slept, though I'm still not sure how, it was to gaze out on a depressing change in the weather. It was a cold, damp day, not calculated to raise the spirits, and I felt unrefreshed and nervous after the previous night. However, Spider seemed her old cheerful self, and after a hot bath and breakfast, and with a new fire blazing in the hearth, I felt strong enough to resume my work. I worked steadily all day, clearing several more piles of rubbish, and then, after dinner, settled in front of the fire with Spider. Outside, a thick fog had descended silently over the island. The causeway was once again invisible. Inside, to while away the time, I turned my attention to a bundle of letters I had found, tied with a narrow purple ribbon and all written in the same hand. They were dated some 60 years before, and sent first from a manor house near Cruthin Gifford, and later from a Scottish lodge. They were all addressed My Dear or Dearest Alice, and signed simply J, or sometimes Janet.
She's obviously a relative of Mrs. Drablow's. Fairly young, I should say, unmarried and with child. Now, in this one, she's obviously still at home with her parents. But then from here on, she's been sent to live in Scotland. Yes, yes, where her son is born. You following all this, Spider, eh? She's apparently under pressure to give the boy up for adoption. But she's obviously desperately fond of him. He is mine. Why should I?
Should I not have what is mine? He shall not go to strangers. I shall kill us both before I let him go.
Ah, here she is again.
What else can I do? I am quite helpless. If you and M are to have him, I shall mind it less. I suppose it must be.
M. Now, who's M? Person unknown, eh, Spider? Ah.
Love him. Take care of him as your own. But he is mine. Mine. He can never be yours. Oh, forgive me. I think my heart will break.
I think my heart will break. Jay. And this is the adoption certificate. Nathaniel Pearson, infant son of Janet Humphrey, is hereby become the child of Morgan Thomas. Ah, Morgan, M, yes. Morgan Thomas Drablow of Ealmarsh House, Criffin Gifford, and of the White House. And this looks like a death... Spider? What is it? Oh, no. We'll put an end to this, even if we have to break the door down to do it. Come on, Spider.
Where there's chopped wood, there has to be an axe. Yes! I thought as much. Kegwick? Kegwick? No. It's not real. Who's in there? Who is it? Open this door. Oh, I shall use this axe.
Stay with me, Spider.
It was a tall, ladder-backed chair made of dark wood with wide, worn, curved runners. As I stared until I could stare no harder, it rocked gently to and fro, as any such chair will rock when someone has just got out of it.
But they would have had to come past me. There's no other way out.
The room I was in was a child's nursery, furnished, equipped, and in such good order that the occupant might only have gone for a walk. There was none of the damp, bare, unlived-in feeling of all the other rooms in the house. There was a bed, a small table with a nightlight, the candle half burnt away. In the chest of drawers, clothes. Clothes for a small boy of 6 or 7. And toys, so many toys. Rows of lead soldiers arranged in regiments. A farm, a model ship with sails of linen. Jigsaws and chess, pens and brushes. Playing cards, a miniature trumpet. And a painted musical box from Switzerland.
They might have been played with this afternoon. And yet they must have been here half a century. Oh, Spider. There's nothing here to frighten us. Just emptiness. Sadness. Something lost. What happened here? Who is it sits here every night, rocking to and fro? Who are they waiting for? What is it, girl? What is it? Spider! They come back! Wait for me!
All right, girl, quiet now. Quiet. There's nobody there. Spider, quiet. Look, I'll show you. There's nobody out there. Spider! Come back! Spider! Spider! Here, girl! Here! Spider! Come on, Spider, where are you? Spider! Here, girl, come on, girl! Spider! Oh, God. It's quicksand.
She was floundering in the mud, fighting to maintain her balance from the pool beneath her feet. Her legs and half her body had disappeared beneath the whirling, sucking bog. Her little head was held up in the air as she struggled and yelped.
Spider! Hang on! I'm coming, girl! You just hold on! Keep still, girl! It's all right! It's all right! Come on, just a few inches, Spider, please! Well, I can't get any nearer! No, that's it! They've got you! I've got you, Spider! Oh, Spider! Spider, it's all right! It's all right! It's all right! It's all right! I've got you! Leave me alone. Please, God. Leave me alone. No!
Episode 3 of The Woman in Black by Susan Hill, dramatized for radio by John Strickland. Old Kipps was played by John Woodvine. Young Kipps by Robert Glenister. The Landlady by Paula Tilbrook. Mr. Jerome by Stuart Richman. Samuel Daly by Rod Arthur. And Mrs. Daly by Diane Whitley. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Peter Bellum, Steve Brook and Maggie Richmond. The music was specially composed by Derek Pierce. The Woman in Black was directed in Manchester by Chris Wallace.
Hi there, I'm Louis Theroux.
Big brother, big brother, big brother.
It's round two of socially distanced conversations.
You were cancelled before it was cool to be cancelled.
Yeah, and got sort of repeatedly cancelled.
From laptop to laptop.
Every week, for 15 years, somebody will say, did you used to do what Louis Theroux did?
I think I'm too close to the mic.
I was going to say I'm just such a huge fan.
Thank you should have said that at the beginning. I would have been so much more relaxed. Grounded with Louis Theroux. Available now on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Woman in Black, from the novel by Susan Hill. Adapted for radio by John Strickland. Episode 4, Letters and Death Certificates.
Kipps! Mr. Kipps!
No! No!
Martha! Mr. Kipps!
No!
Martha, it's all right. It's all right. It's me, Sam Daly. What the hell are you doing out here, man? You'll catch your death.
Mr. Daly, I thought you...
All right, all right. Don't waste your breath trying to talk. Let's get you out of here. Come on.
She was at the window. She was watching me. I saw her. She was watching me drown. Someone whistled. Spider ran. I tried to call her, but she wouldn't come back. Spider!
She's here. Spider. It's all right. She'll do, won't you, girl? Now, come on. You able to walk?
Yeah. There's a door. It's upstairs. Wouldn't open. I was going to use the axe and break it down, but it swung open before I
did it. That's it. Come on. Easy now.
There was a chair. It was a rocking chair, but no one was there. And someone whistled. And I came out, and a spider ran.
Yeah, she's a good runner. Now, come on, let's get you inside, in the warm.
But the trap. That pony and trap.
Out the front.
But...
Oh, I still like to make use of it now and again. It's a pleasant way to travel, and it's a sight safer than a motor car across that causeway. What did you think?
I'd heard others. Another.
Oh, aye. Keckwick, perhaps.
No, not Keckwick.
Well, you were told to take care. Now then, sit yourself closer to the fire. Warm up a bit.
No, I'm better. I'm all right now. It was... I could use a drink.
Oh, I can't help you there. Here, have a swig of that.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, that's good. I wouldn't come out on a night like this without a flask.
Why did you come out, Mr. Daly?
I had you on me mind. I weren't happy. It began to unsettle me.
But it's quite early in the morning, isn't it? I've become so confused.
Middle of the night. I kept waking. Like I say, I had you on me mind. And it's a good job I came when I did.
Yes, I'm very grateful. I can't actually remember. I can't even remember how I got in here.
I carried you in, Arthur. You were pretty far gone out there.
Well, I am extremely glad to see you, Mr. Daly.
Aye, you've good reason. People have drowned on that marsh before now.
Yes. Yes, I know that now. I was being pulled under, and the dog with me. And she was watching it all.
Anyway, there. Now you've come to a bit more, you best get whatever you need and we'll be off.
Off?
Aye. I came to see how you were faring in this godforsaken place. Well, I have seen. Now you'd better come back home with me and recover yourself.
For my work.
And what have you found here, Mr. Kipps? A map to buried treasure?
No. A great quantity of rubbish, Mr. Daly, and precious little else. But the job will have to be done at some time or other.
I am obliged to do it. Sometime, Arthur. Not now.
No, you're right. There are some letters, papers here I want to take with me. And I have to go upstairs.
Upstairs? Why?
I need to see something.
I'll come with you.
No. I must do it on my own.
You won't learn, will you, Arthur?
Please. I have to.
Go on, then. I'll wait for you here. Just shout if
there's
any...
I won't be long.
The room that had been so ordered only hours before now lay in a state of total disarray. Sheets and blankets had been pulled from the bed and lay trailed across the floor. The wardrobe door and the drawers of the small chest had been thrown open, the clothes dragged out and left hanging like entrails from a wounded body. The lead soldiers had been knocked down like ninepins. Books lay open, their jackets torn, soft toys were split and unclothed. The bedside table was overturned. And the rocking chair had been pushed into the center to stand like a great brooding bird over the wreckage. And somewhere beneath it all, the music box played.
Mr. Daly, I'm ready when you are.
As we crossed the Nine Lives Causeway for what I fervently prayed was the last time, the tide was dropping back steadily, The sky was a uniform pearly grey, the air moist and cold and still. The marshes lay dull and misty all about us, and ahead the flat countryside stood dripping and colourless. At Mr. Daly's, a room had been prepared for me, and I was left alone to sleep fitfully through the morning, my mind in a fever of confusion. I awoke at 1, little refreshed, but forced myself to take a hot bath and eat a light lunch, and then passed the afternoon in the peace and tranquillity of my room, rereading Janet's letters that I had brought with me from the island, slowly piecing together the tragic story that seemed to be centred still at Eel Marsh House. In the same bundle with the letters were 3 death certificates.
Nathaniel Drablow, aged 6 years. Cause of death, drowning. Rose Judd, nursemaid. Cause of death, drowning.
The 3rd certificate was dated some 12 years later.
Janet Eliza Humphrey, spinster, age 36. Cause of death, heart failure. Come in.
It's only me, Arthur. Come to see how you look. Will you live, do you think?
Oh, yes, I'm sure I shall. I feel a good deal better already. Thank you for last night.
Aye. You've come a long way since the night I met you on the late train.
Feels like 100 years.
Aye, you've gone through some rough seas.
Well, I'm in the calm now, and there's an end of it.
That's to be hoped, for sure.
Surely you don't think any more harm can come of it? I never intend to go back there. Nothing would persuade me.
No? That's good.
So all is well. Though I do wonder what will happen to the house. I can't imagine anyone wanting to live there. Do you suppose that poor old Mrs. Drabbler was haunted by...
A sister.
Sister? The woman in black?
Janet Humphrey. She was the sister, Alice Drablow's. Or Alice Humphrey, as she was before she wed Morgan Drablow.
And did she, too, have to endure those dreadful noises out there night and day? I wonder how she did it without going out of her mind.
Perhaps she didn't.
Was there something I still did not see, Mr. Daly? If I had stayed there any longer, would I have encountered yet more horrors?
That I can't tell.
But you could tell me something. Come on, we're a good way from the place, and my nerves are quite steady again. I must know. It can't hurt me now.
Not you, Arthur. No, not you, maybe.
For God's sake, what is it you're holding back? What are you so afraid to tell me?
You, Arthur, you'll be away from here in a day or so. If you're lucky, you'll neither see nor hear nor know of anything to do with that damn place again. The rest of us have to stay. We've to live with it.
With what? Stories? Rumours? With the sight of that woman in black from time to time? With what?
With... whatever will surely follow some time or other. Crithen Gifford has lived with that for 50 years. It's changed people. They don't speak of it. You found that out. And those who suffered worst say least. Jerome, Keckwick.
How do you mean, suffered?
Very well. If you must be told, then you must. Janet Humphrey never married. She gave up her child, the boy, to her sister and her husband, Alison Morgan Drablow, because she'd no choice. At first she stayed away, hundreds of miles away, in Scotland. And the boy was raised as a Drablow, never intended to know different. But in the end, the pain of being parted from him, instead of easing, grew worse for Janet. And so she returned to Crithin. She wasn't welcome at her parents' house, and the boy's father had gone abroad, so she took rooms in the town. Are you sure you want to hear this?
Go on, please.
Well, at first Alice Drablow wouldn't let her see the boy at all. But Janet was so distressed she threatened violence, and in the end the sister relented, just so far. Janet could visit very occasionally, but never see the boy alone and never disclose to him who she was. No one ever foresaw that he'd turn out to look so like her, or that the natural affinity between them would grow out. the little boy became more and more attached to her. And as he did so, he began to be colder towards Alice Drablow. Janet planned to take him away. But before she could do so, the accident happened, just as you heard. The boy, the nursemaid Rose Judd, the pony trap and its driver, Keckwick.
Keckwick?
Keckwick's father. And there was the boy's little dog, too.
My God.
Well, that's a treacherous place. You found that out. That sea fret sweeps across the marshes. The quicksands are hidden.
So they all drowned?
Aye. And Janet Humphrey watched.
What?
She was back at the house, watching from the nursery window, waiting for them to return.
That poor woman.
The bodies were recovered. Though they left the pony trap, that were held too fast by the mud. And from that day on, Janet Humphrey began to go mad.
Was there any wonder?
No. Mad with grief, and mad with anger, and a desire for revenge.
Revenge?
Aye. Well, she blamed her sister for letting them go out, though it was no one's fault. That mist comes down without warning.
Out of a clear sky.
Now, whether because of her loss or a madness or what, Janet also contracted a disease, which caused her to begin to waste away. The flesh shrank from her bones. The colour was drained from her. She looked like a walking skeleton. When she went about the streets, people drew back. Everyone were terrified of her. And eventually, she died. She died in hatred and misery. And as soon as ever she died, the hauntings began. And so they've gone on.
What, all the time? Ever since?
No. Less these past few years. But she's still seen, and the noise is heard, by folk chancing to be out on the marsh.
And presumably by old Mrs. Drablow.
Who knows?
But Mrs. Drablow is dead now. There, surely, the whole matter will rest.
Whenever she's been seen, in the graveyard, on the marsh, in the streets of the town, however briefly and whoever by, there's been one sure and certain result.
Yes?
In some violent circumstance, a child has died.
What? You mean by some accident?
Oh, generally an accident. Once or twice it's been after an illness that struck them down within a day or night or less.
You mean a child of the town?
Any child. Jerome's child.
Mr. Jerome. Which would explain his behaviour in the churchyard.
But surely children sometimes do die.
They do, Mr. Kipps. They do.
And is there anything more than chance to connect these deaths with the appearance of that woman?
Chance? Oh, you may find it hard to believe, Arthur. You may doubt it.
Well, no,
we know.
I do not doubt, Mr. Daly. If you would excuse me, I think I should like to rest now.
And so you should, Arthur. I'll leave you. You'll need your strength for your journey home tomorrow. Though you know you're welcome to stop here for as long as you like.
That's most kind. But I've a deep longing for London. Strange though it may seem to you. And Stella is waiting for me there.
Well, you know your own mind. But for now, I should try and get some sleep. Come on down when you feel like some supper.
Oh, dearest Stella. Why did I ever come up here? How I miss you.
I slept long but wretchedly. I slept, but woke every hour from turbulent nightmares, my body bathed in sweat. I slept, but the woman in black was sitting on the end of the bed, pushing her face suddenly down close to mine, so that I sat up and cried out in terror. I slept, and my head rang with the sound of a child crying out on the marsh, the rocking chair crashing to and fro, the splintering of the pony trap as it was sucked into the quicksand. And all the time, held up before my mind's eye, were those letters and the death certificates, every word of which I feverishly repeated over and over and over.
Rose Judd, nursemaid. Cause of death.
Drowning.
Drowning.
Rose Judd.
Janet, Eliza, Humphrey.
Drowning.
Spinster.
Janet, Eliza, Humphrey.
Age 36.
Age 36.
Cause of death.
Cause of death. Heart failure.
Heart failure.
I slept. And when I woke, the fever and delirium finally gone, I was utterly exhausted, drained. But I was well. There was nothing else the woman could do to me. I had endured and survived.
Arthur? Arthur, you're awake.
Stella? Stella! Where am I? How did I get home?
Arthur, you're still at Mr. Daly's. You've been very ill, my darling. I've been so worried. We all were.
But I was just talking to Mr. Daly. I'm travelling back today to see you.
The doctor has called every day. You've had the most terrible fever. Mr. Daly sent word to the office, and as soon as Mr. Bentley told me, I took the train up to be with you. Oh, Arthur, whatever has happened to you here?
How long have I been ill, Stella?
12 days or more. Oh, Arthur, I feared I might lose you.
Oh, no chance of that, I'm afraid. I come from good yeoman stock.
I couldn't stand to live without you, Arthur.
Shush, you won't have to. I'm better now. Look at me. All danger is past.
Yes. Yes, I believe it is, and whatever it was that did this to you, I shall not allow it to happen again. As soon as you're a little stronger, we shall travel back to London together. We shall be married as we planned, and I shall never let you out of my sight again, Arthur Kipps.
Oh, I think Mr. Bentley might have something to say about that.
And Mr. Bentley and I are agreed. He bitterly regrets having sent you to this place. He asks you to forgive him.
Well, I do. I'm quite certain he wasn't to know. And anyway, I'm not sure I do regret having come here altogether. The experience has changed me, Stella. I have seen and heard terrible things here, I cannot deny that. And yet, I know, too, something of the pain and suffering that lay behind it all. I can't explain it, but somehow I feel I do understand. Out there, in the middle of it all, I became another person. Or at the very least, experienced emotions that belonged to another. Can you understand at all, Stella?
I'm not sure, Arthur. I don't know what went on out there, but I will try, believe me.
Oh, I was so young, so arrogant when I arrived here from London. And I'd been taught a lesson. A hard lesson, perhaps, but one I was sore in need of learning. And then, too, I have been the recipient of so much kindness, Stella. From people who barely knew me. Kettwick, the landlord and his wife, Mr. and Mrs. Daly. I fear I shall not be able to repay half my debts.
Oh, there will be time for all that when you are quite well again, my dearest. The doctor says that if we take great care, you may be fit enough to travel tomorrow. But that when we reach London, you must still rest and build up your strength.
Forgive the intrusion, but we could hear you talking up here, so we knew you were awake. I've been sent up to see if you're well enough to take a little food.
I'm a good deal recovered, Mr. Daly, thank you. We are hoping to travel back to London tomorrow. I've imposed on your hospitality more than enough.
Don't be foolish, man. It was the very least we could do.
I'll go and find Mrs. Daly. She'll be wanting to tell cook numbers for dinner.
Spider's been looking for you.
How is she?
Oh, she's none the worse.
I shall miss her a great deal. I think we grew quite fond of each other. I was going to ask you if you might let me take her back with me. But I don't think she's a London dog.
I should hope she's not. But she'll be whelping some time or other.
If you're serious, I'll keep one of the pups for you.
Well, it would certainly be a good reason for you to come and visit us.
Aye.
Well, no, not that you need a reason. You know that, I hope. I owe you my life, Mr. Daly. I shan't forget that.
I'm not a city man myself, but we usually visit once or twice a year. And we'll certainly make it our business to come and check up on you.
I must know, Mr. Daly.
Know what?
You told me that a child has always died in Criffin Gifford whenever the woman in black has been seen.
Aye.
I must know.
Nothing. Nothing has happened.
Oh, pray God it may not. Pray that the chain is broken, that her power is at an end, that I was the last ever to see her.
Aye. Pray God. She was a poor, troubled woman.
The following morning we left the house. There was a sadness at parting company with Mr. and Mrs. Daly, but in truth, nothing more. I did not wish to see the town again, did not want to risk meeting Mr. Jerome or Keckwick, and most of all, I didn't want to catch so much as a glimpse of the distant marsh. The doctor had told me to put the whole thing from my mind, and with Stella beside me, it already seemed as if it might all have happened to another person altogether. Little did I know that the worst was yet to come. Stella and I returned to London, and within 6 weeks we had married, quietly and without fuss. We were as happy as a young man and his bride could possibly be, content in each other's company, not rich, but not poor either, busy and looking forward to the future. A little over a year later, Stella gave birth to our child, a son, whom we called Joseph Arthur Samuel. Mr. Daly was his godfather. Oh, I was so filled with joy and contentment in my life that I never so much as thought about the past. Ealmarsh House, the Drablow Estate, Jennet Humphrey, these were names that were never mentioned again. And I was in a particularly peaceful, happy frame of mind one Sunday afternoon in the summer of the year following Joseph's birth. We had gone to a large park, 10 miles or so outside London. There was a lake, a bandstand, stalls selling ices and fruits. Families strolled in the sunshine, children tumbled about upon the grass. There was a festive holiday air about the place as Stella and I walked happily, with young Joseph taking a few unsteady steps, holding on to our hands while we watched him, as proud as any parents could be. One of the attractions on offer was a pony and trap, on which rides could be taken down an avenue of great horse chestnut trees. There was only room enough for 2 passengers, so Stella took Joseph, and I stood watching them bowl merrily away down the ride.
You hold on tight, Joseph. I'll wait for you here.
They went out of sight round a bend, and I began to look idly about me at the other enjoyers of the afternoon. And then, quite suddenly, I saw her, standing by one of the trees, Jennet Humphrey, the woman in black, with the wasted face.
Oh, my God.
Our eyes met, just as they had done in that old burial ground on the island. I felt once more her power, the malevolence, the hatred, the passionate bitterness. And, just as before, I could not take my eyes away from her. I knew that something terrible was about to happen, and that there was nothing, nothing I could do to prevent it.
No!
She stepped out into the path of the pony.
No! No!
Our baby son, little Joseph Arthur, was thrown against a tree. He lay crumpled on the grass below it. Dead. And 10 long months later, Stella too died from her terrible injuries.
It's past 3 o'clock. What are you doing down here, Stu?
I'd seen the ghost. And she had her revenge.
Arthur! What is it? What's wrong?
Oh, Esri, Esri. Oh. I'm so sorry. Forgive me.
Forgive you for what?
Oh, so many things. Things that made me what I am today, and an old man haunted by his past.
Stella.
Forgive me.
You've never spoken to me of her. In all these years, Arthur. Why? What happened to her?
I can't speak. I can't speak of her, Esme. Even now I can't speak. Which is why I've been writing it all down. It's all here for you to read after I'm dead.
Arthur, tonight, please.
Tonight, when the children were telling ghost stories and they asked me to tell one and I shouted at them to leave me alone, I...
It doesn't matter, Arthur. They've forgotten about it already.
But they were right, Esme. I did have a story, a true story. And I knew that until I told it, not aloud by the fireside, not as an idle diversion, but until I exorcised it, I would have no rest from it. And that is what I've done tonight. I've set it all down on paper, every detail. At last. And if I weep now, Esme, they are tears of relief at having driven this ghost from within me after all these years.
Oh, Arthur. Arthur, there. There.
They were almost back. And we would have gone, Esme. We would have been safe. They were almost back. They'd almost reached me.
It's all right, Arthur. It's all over now. You're quite safe now.
I saw the ghost of Janet Humphrey. And she had her revenge. Stella! Joseph!
In the final episode of The Woman in Black by Susan Hill, dramatized for radio by John Strickland, Old Kipps was played by John Woodvine, Young Kipps by Robert Glenister, Esme by Paula Tilbrook, Stella by Jane Cox, and Samuel Daly by Rod Arthur. Other parts were played by members of the cast. Technical presentation was by Peter Bellum, Steve Brook, and Maggie Richmond. The music was specially composed by Derek Pierce. The Woman in Black was directed in Manchester by Chris Wallace.